There's a price to be paid when you don't pay attention to emotion.
Welcome back to another episode of Heal Your Roots podcast. I am your co-host, Daniela Galdi. I'm so thrilled to be here today to talk with Kira and Jean, who you'll meet in just a second, because they are phenomenal therapists who have been supporting each other throughout their work.
Hello. Hi, everybody. This is Kira Yakubov, founder and lead therapist at Heal Your Roots Wellness. Every episode, we have a new therapist and practitioner in the mental health field, so we can get to know them more as a person outside of the therapy field, but also what they love to do inside of the field. So today, I am super excited to have Jean Thayer Meston, licensed marriage and family therapist, with us with over 40 years of phenomenal experience. Thank you so much for being on today, Jean.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so you mentioned you are 40 years in the business, and I know you, Jean, because Kira has said amazing things about you and gone to you for different types of mentorship. So I would love to hear a little bit more about your background, as well as for the listeners to know, you know, what it is that you focus on in your work.
I'm going to bring me back if I go too far afield, but I'm thinking about when I was a high school teacher and I taught American history in a public high school, and then slowly students would start to find me after school or when I was in study hall, and they would, you know, say, can I, Miss Meston, can I talk to you about something? And then they would tell me these secrets and what was going on in their families and what was going on in their lives. And I realized that I was more excited about helping them than I was about teaching history. So at the end of my first year of teaching, I applied to graduate school at Rutgers University, since I lived in New Jersey, in counseling psychology, thinking that I would be a high school guidance counselor or counselor. And so I did a master's at Rutgers. Then I got my first professional job, which was at being in a counseling center at Gettysburg College. And that was where I realized that if I met with these students individually, I would not have as much impact as I would if I could see them with a parent or a sibling or a partner. And so it made me pay attention to marriage and family therapy. And somewhere when I, and also when I was at Rutgers, is when I got exposed to working in human sexuality. So the place to train in the United States in 1976 was Marriage Council of Philadelphia, which was associated with the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, and I got to train there. So it was a one-year intensive training in therapy with couples. We would go over to Child Guidance Clinic and learn about family therapy, and we were trained in sex education and sex therapy. Phew. So
you have had a lot of accomplishments.
Yes.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it was really cool.
I know that I want to know more about the human sexuality part, but Kira, do you have any questions? Since I know you and Jean have such a close relationship, what is it that you love about the work that she does?
Yeah, absolutely. So I know I originally, when I started talking to Jean, we were discussing couples work. And my first question usually is for, you know, people who come, guests who come on the show, is how did you get into the therapy field? And you kind of just really laid it out for us, so I appreciate that. What do you enjoy about couples work? Because I know that you do see a lot of couples and people in marriages. Is there some part or aspect of couples work that you enjoy the most?
Well, of course, I love when they start having a mirror held up. They get better. And I think the other thought is, it's the gift of thinking systemically, so that when I look at a couple, I'm not thinking two individuals. I'm thinking about the third part, which is what they create together. So there's the marriage, and then there's each of them. And to help them think about system, the system they're caught in sometimes, means that they feel less guilty and are more open and more comfortable, so that they know that I'm not thinking that they're a bad person. I'm saying, actually, when you do this behavior, your wife then reacts to what you did and said, and then you react to her reaction, and that's what keeps getting over and over again, repeated and repeated. So it's not that you're a bad person. It's that where you came from and where you were raised, you learned certain ways to keep from getting hurt. And unfortunately, our way of not getting hurt hurts our partner and vice versa. But to think about it as, I guess I'm adding a fourth entity to the three, which is this repeating negative cycle that you've been stuck in and not realizing it. And the most common pattern is for one person to be a critical person, what we in emotionally focused couples therapy call a critical pursuer. I am a recovering pursuer. Oh my God, it's horrible to think about some of the things I did because I was insecure, and that poor boyfriend getting all of my, am I okay? And if you don't talk to me more and express more emotions, I'm going to think you don't like me. And then I'm going to be mean to you. Or the most important thing is that someone's going to withdraw. So if I'm pursuing and saying, please pay attention to me, please pay attention to me, it's more likely that he's going to be, oh my God, I don't know what she wants from me. I think I better not say anything so that I don't do the wrong thing. And there's the pattern. So that's the repeating cycle over and over again. So moving ahead, first we have to help the couple see that this thing is outside of them. Also, they'll begin to figure out from the families they grew up in sort of where it came from. And then beginning to reflect back the deeper emotions. And when the partner hears deeper emotions, they don't do their usual of either shutting down or attacking. And then they start to get better and better. So it's really wonderful when people get better.
So what you're saying here is that therapy is necessary. And I believe that, I think it was Heal Your Roots, Heal Your Roots Wellness social media that you just posted possibly about you don't have to wait for something to be wrong to have therapy, or you don't have to wait till it's almost time for a divorce.
Correct. The sooner people come in, then the better chance we therapists have of making a difference. For sure. It's tough. There's something else. There's a marriage therapist, he and his wife, John Gottman, and I can't remember her name right now, but the two of them,
it's Julie.
Yeah. That's right. It is. Yeah. So we've got this negative cycle that keeps repeating, over which the couple, they didn't realize they were doing it. They didn't realize they knew that they were repeating in the sense that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. But one of the things that Gottman pulled out of all of the hundreds and hundreds of studies about the effectiveness or not effectiveness of couples work was the only one that he said had to do with gender. And that is that in marriages or relationships where a woman feels that she can influence in a heterosexual couple, influence her husband, that reduces the probability of divorce significantly. So if she feels that if she talks to him from the heart about how she sees it with the kids or her job or his relationship or whatever with his family, and he hears her and can actually be affected by it, that really helps the relationship. And I'm imagining that in same-sex relationships, that we have something going on. I think probably that it's not gender related. I think we all want to feel like we can make a difference and that somebody thinks our opinion is to be valued.
So I know that when so just for the listeners, Jean is like my mentor. I come to her for mentorship. And so we've discussed many of my clients and couples. And something that I really loved when we talked is when you outline this infinity, right? So if the listeners can imagine an infinity sign, that when couples are arguing, on top of the infinity sign, right, is their adult version. This is us and how we react. And then when we do something that can trigger or elicit a response from our younger selves and how we might respond. And so if you can explain, because you explained it so beautifully that it stuck with me, that I told my husband about it, but he loved it, the way that you explained it to kind of the listeners of like what that looks like when we are in arguments and there's different parts of us coming through.
So listeners, and of course both Kira and I just were going to use our hands, but think of putting an eight on its side and then draw a vertical line. Is that vertical? No, horizontal line. Mm-hmm. Draw a horizontal line through the eight on its side. And above the line is our conscious adult self. And below the line is often our unconscious child self. Now, if we put our hand up in to the left and to that partner, and they say something to their partner on the right, it's going to, and the partner responds negatively, what the person doesn't see on the right is how her message goes underneath and impacts the partner who's heard her speak or him speak in a bad way. And then his adult response and reaction to the child message or the child feelings that came up is to withdraw or pursue with her in a way that she gets hit. Mm-hmm. So the line on the side that goes underneath each of them is where the message from the adult goes to the kid. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why we get stuck.
Oh. And a lot of that when you were sharing is from our families, right? Like how we learned or... A lot of the triggers are the messages we received early on, right? So I grew up in an immigrant family, very conservative. It was very stereotypical gender roles. So I was around a lot of very dominant, loud men. And so I didn't have the opportunity to argue back. I would just shut down. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to be silent here and then do what I have to do behind the scenes. And so that has carried with me unconsciously as an adult when I feel like someone is coming at me or arguing too aggressively, I just shut down. And I kind of go back into that childlike version of myself. And I can see how much that can impact my partner or other relationships. And so, I mean, it's really powerful insight to know this younger version of us that's used to behaving a certain way to protect ourselves.
Yeah, that is so important. And then our poor partner, and that, if we pick that up, mm-hmm. they don't understand why we just shut down. So they're thinking, oh my God, what did I say? What's, you know, mm-hmm. is she mad at me? And of course, we've gone back into that place where the only answer is to be quiet.
Yeah.
But they think it's their fault. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's just they accidentally hit that spot.
So to let me clarify for you both, in terms of reacting, do you think it's from the behavior of, let's say, the loudness or the tone, or is it a play on both the subconscious, what's happened as a child, and then the behavior as well? Like, can it be a combination of both? Is it a combination of both?
I think it is. And I think a really cool thing that's happened in, I don't know, the last 7 years, let's say, is that since the ability to talk with people and scan their brains and have us watch their brains when they speak, mm-hmm. we know where in the brain, what emotion is coming from where. And it's pretty amazing that what our brain does and when. So let's say if I get angry because my boyfriend is scared of me and he's shut down. And then I lose control of that emotion because my amygdala, that part in the brain that is to save our lives, it's what tells us that we're in danger and we better run or freeze, fight. There we go. So when that flashes, I can't take in anything the boyfriend tells me. Mm-hmm. Because he's afraid of my activation and my anger, and he's trying to protect himself by freezing. because that's how he survived in his loud, obnoxious family. And here I am, unbeknownst to me, duplicating the loud, obnoxious family. So I feel like he's making me into a monster, like I'm this bad person. So I get madder when he withdraws, which validates for him it's a good idea to withdraw. His child is going, good move, right? She is dangerous. And it would never occur to him that what's going on inside me is maybe I'm not lovable. My being loud and expressing myself so directly and hotly and sometimes self-righteously is scaring him away. Maybe that means that I'm unlovable. And he's thinking, well, she's not leaving the room. She's still sort of trying to connect to me. So maybe that means it's okay that I shut down. So you can see how we get stuck. We keep doing the same thing over and over.
Yeah. And it's these beliefs, right? That we may not even recognize, or they're not like saying it in our head, right? It's not like the voice that is saying this.
Well done. I think it's that those old lessons in our family of origin stimulate the physiology that underlies the two behaviors. And there are people, it's rare. Sometimes people come in and they're a withdrawal couple. They've both sort of given up, or they've both kind of taken, let's not talk because then talking could lead to fighting. And so they're very separate. And sometimes, of course, it escalates and we've got people who do not know how to speak to each other without it's being highly elevated. Mm-hmm. The new phrase is affect dysregulation. And we see it in children who are, quote, acting out in elementary school, where that part of the brain that's supposed to save us from death and bad stuff flashes, and then I can't hear what anybody says to me. I'm panicked. My heart rate goes up. My breathing goes up.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. And I wish that everyone could see me mimicking my inaudible, like, light bulb moment from everything you're saying. And speaking of the amygdala, I keep giggling to myself because I'm like, oh, that baby is flashing.
Isn't that great? And I had one client one time, I love this, and she came in and she said, well, I had an amygdala hijack.
Isn't that great? It's like, it made me do it.
Yeah. It's not the devil. It's my amygdala.
And so I know that when you're expressing it's physiologically something happening, it's, for me at least, for listeners who, if you've heard of stonewalling or shutting down, right, the intention is important behind the stonewalling, I think, for couples to understand, or anybody really who's in discussion with somebody else in like a heated situation, is that it could be that our body, like you're saying, totally takes over and I no longer feel safe. I don't feel safe. I feel powerless. The best way that my body knows how to get through this moment is to be silent and wait for it to be over. So it's more of a protective mechanism versus we have sometimes when it can be manipulative is I'm going to actively ignore you and not speak to you. And both of those can be very hurtful for the other partner on the other end. They may not know the intention right away, but it's painfully and deeply hurtful. Because if you think about when you're a child, your parent just shutting down and ignoring you altogether. It's hurtful. And so I think having a partner know the intention behind what's happening is important. And so, Jean, do you have any tips for people who do shut down or they stonewall to move through those moments?
Well, I'm going to maybe add an element. So you're alluding beautifully and explaining beautifully Gottman's Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which is criticism. So I think that pursuer peace, criticism, the other person, if they feel criticized, is going to be defensive. Mm-hmm. and they're either going to shut down or they're going to react verbally back and you'll have a fight. But let's hypothesize that in cases where you don't go back and have a fight, you're describing your own, you learned, if I could just be invisible, it'll go better for me. And then that makes the criticizer increase their criticism and distress in order to get through the what becomes the stonewall and the stonewalling. So it's criticism makes defensiveness. If the person keeps criticizing, then we're going to build a wall. And then what Gottman suggests is that if that keeps going, that eventually one of them is going to have contempt for the other.
And that's the worst.
And that's the worst. If people come in and every time their partner speaks, the other partner is rolling their eyes, that usually means they're contemptuous of the partner. And that usually means they're not going to make repair.
Even going back to like the stonewalling or shutting down is the mindfulness piece and the awareness, right? So it took me a while to recognize that when I shut down, that is a huge trigger for my partner, right? Like it makes it worse. It doesn't make it better. It makes maybe your experience less uncomfortable because you're going into your shell and like forgetting about what anyone else is going through in that moment. But it's having like that wise mind, that awareness, like, okay, I'm recognizing I'm shutting down. I'm pushing my partner out. In the long term, this is going to be much worse. So how can I stay in the room? And how can I express like, listen, like I'm too overwhelmed and too overstimulated to have this conversation. I need a moment, right? Like asking for that break or just expressing what you're experiencing and not getting back into the content of the argument to slow things down. And so like, have you seen that in person with couples when you see that moment where maybe one partner recognizes how they're behaving or how they're being defensive and slowing down to stop a cycle?
I remember when I was trying to learn not to be defensive if somebody criticized me, which is enormously hard. Mm-hmm. And this boyfriend at the time was telling me how much his mother hated me and why. Oh, please. Oh, we'll have that conversation. So, and I was sitting in denial. I said, oh, no, it's fine. I know she hates me. I took you away. Right. But after we hung up and I said, oh, no, it doesn't bother me. The things that you told me that your mother said about me, like deny. And then when we hung up, I had the moment the phone was put down, I had a splitting headache. Deny. But bodies don't let us deny. It was amazing. So I have to say the denial didn't work, right? Shutdown isn't working. I let his telling me that information hurt me. She thinks I'm a terrible person. But going back to trying, if it's the other way, yeah, of how to, one way with friends anyhow, if I get defensive, and this was pretty, my first step in not being defensive was to say aloud, oh, that was really defensive, wasn't it? And they go, yeah. Right. So it's like I have this little wiser version of myself that's outside of me saying, whoa, that was pretty defensive. And so it's about trying to develop, there's a approach in therapy, a group approach called dialectical behavioral therapy. And they talk about having a rational mind, which makes sense, you know, the one that's based on facts and not emotions, the emotional mind, which is, you know, all emotion. And then they talk about developing our wise mind. And wise mind is the combination of both. That we don't want to be so rational that we're an automaton and a robot. And emotion is good. It's honest and it's important to be expressed and to learn how to express in a way that we don't really hurt other people. We don't want to repress it and suppress it, or you'll get a headache like I just described, mm-hmm. or irritable bowel syndrome or addiction. There's a price to be paid when you don't pay attention to emotion. So I love this idea about the putting them together into Wise Mind. And that's a Marsha Linehan gift from DBT when she created it. And the more we, another piece about the physiology piece is that studies are showing us that if we could learn to meditate, doesn't mean you go om and cross your legs when you're having a conversation with your partner. It means once a day or twice a day that you stop, tune into yourself quietly, breathe, and slowly through practicing what's called mindful meditation, you can actually calm your amygdala down. It's wild. We can actually make a difference. Being a little ADHD, I love when I minimize a little ADHD. just a smidgen. Isn't that funny? And I tell people, I flunked my first two attempts at classes in mindfulness meditation. I did 3 classes and then I'd make up an excuse and run away. I did 2 and then 3. And then when finally I tried, this is persistence helps. So then I had an opportunity, a person at Penn, Dr. Bame, Michael Bame, created a course specifically for psychotherapists, he taught the foundation course of mindfulness to therapists. So it was psychiatrists, marriage and family, psychologists. And I got through the whole thing and I did the homework and it really was amazing. So this new knowledge about how our brains work, and also that has helped us begin to understand trauma and why there's having COVID. I'll tell you, well, where my brain just went, you described beautifully. That was beautiful, where self-awareness, and then also this piece about recognizing I can impact the partner, and I don't want to hurt that person. My goal is not to hurt them. It's unintentional. So you start not wanting to do it anymore because your partner isn't the person who's hurt you and sent you there, but also that you see his distress. And when we're activated, when that amygdala has flashed, I don't see anybody's distress. All I'm into is my own distress. Mm-hmm. And then the piece about heart rate, it was Gottman who had his couples wear heart rate monitors when he sees them.
That's right.
And when their heart rate monitor, when their hearts were over 110, they're just sitting on the couch talking about their relationship with Dr. Gottman. They couldn't take in anything that Dr. Gottman said or anything that their partner said. It was like they were unreachable. And so it wasn't even a stone wall. It's just, they were so aroused and upset and distressed that they couldn't do it. So whether we're the pursuer who needs to bring down that stuff so that I can be there with my partner, or the withdrawer who has to come up, come to think of it, up from the safe place. Wait a minute, I have to come out of my room. Yes, you have to come out of your room. Isn't that cool? Yeah, so the self-awareness helps a lot. And then I think our compassion muscle starts to get stronger. I would say to people, I couldn't see the distress on my boyfriend's face. He was terrified when I'd be, putting him down or getting louder or crying hysterically. I hate to use that word. Hysterically usually would be it. And of course, I'd be scared too if I were on the other side of me when I was in that place. So if we become the bulldozers, we need to become aware of it and reduce get our bulldozers smaller and smaller. And if we run away and go to our safe room, we got to kind of like, how about we have it 3 steps away instead of 20? Well, I think one of the ways that us humans try not to feel bad is to blame other people for our feeling bad. And I used to make a joke to some of my couples, like, you do know why we get married. And they say, no, why do we get married? And I said, so we'll have someone to blame. When I was single, I just had it all together, right? Because these things don't come up when we're on our own. We don't do this to our girlfriends, right? Or, yeah, we just don't. So one of the things, so I guess one piece is beginning to use our feelings to go backwards and ask ourselves, what is it that I'm trying to put on someone else? And what's going on with me? Not they did this to me or you made me feel this way. Because usually it's not them. It's something going on with us. Now, in the meantime, blaming other people can be hurtful to them. It's hurtful to us because then we won't grow and learn and be better human beings. But it's also hurtful to the people we blame because we use the blame as an excuse for not communicating or for being cold or all the different ways that we'll show our feelings. So let's say, and I'm trying to pick up here what Danielle alluded to, we're going to hurt each other. I mean, we know this from growing up in our families, not that it's on, but the big important thing is it on purpose? Often we're going to make mistakes, say the wrong thing, misunderstand, but we can reflect and go back to the person and say later, oh, you know what? I think I cut you off. I don't think I was paying attention. I'm so sorry. Would you tell me again what you said on Saturday? So this, we're moving closer to self, this hooking up self-responsibility and the forgiveness piece. In order to move forward, it's so important that we learn how to do honest apologies. And now that I think about it, last night I watched an episode of I Have Never Ever, if any of you watch it. It is about an Eastern Indian girl who's growing up in California and she's in high school. It's hilarious. And it's written by Mindy King. Is that her name? Oh, guys, you will love it. My listeners, if you haven't watched it, it's pretty wonderful. And she has done a girlfriend dirty. This is high school politics 101. She really, you know, was jealous of this. It's the only other Indian girl suddenly comes from a different school system. And of course that puts Debbie off. So she does all these bad things and is very, very hurtful to the new girl who she buddied up with. And then you watch her go for her attempts at apology. She realizes that she was way out of line and very hurtful. And she tries to make excuses and, you know, we watch her go through it. And she goes to her therapist, by the way, who's this classic funny Black woman who calls it like it is. And she sort of scolds Debbie and says, no, those aren't apologies, what you've just done. So you have to say aloud what it is that you did and take full responsibility for it. And you have to say aloud, I see that I hurt you. And I was wrong. Ooh, that's a really good one. So that's a healthy forgiveness. Now, when we were talking earlier, I said, and I sort of think of it on the spectrum or in continuum of apology / forgiveness, is on one end, that's extreme, is I will never, ever forgive you. You've hurt me to the core and I'm just not ever going to forget or forgive. Then we've got over on the other side, and I think I used to do this, non-assertiveness. Oh, it's okay. It wasn't that bad. Oh, you're forgiven. I would sort of dismiss somebody trying to make an honest apology. It's okay. It's really, it wasn't that, you know. So neither of those are going to lead to spiritual or emotional growth. So it's that one that Debbie finally got the button in the middle. It's wise mind. And recently I had this, gosh, was this hard. My younger brother. So anyhow, if I hurt my brother, he would just ghost me. And I would know that I'd done something wrong. Not because he told me, but because suddenly he's not speaking to me, not calling me, not in my life. And I would then talk to my two sisters and say, oh, Larry's ghosted me again. Like I'm a victim. This is actually pretty funny now that I think about it. And slowly I realized, you know what? I'm doing something that hurts him. And I did. I called him and I said, Larry, I just want to talk for a moment. And you don't have to answer this right now. But I think that there are things that I do just being me that run over top of you, interrupt you, feel condescending, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And I would love your help because I hate that I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. And I'm so sorry that it took this long for me to, like, instead of making fun of you, could approach me. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was the best. And he didn't have to wait. And he told me the things that really sort of would make him feel bad. And I said, thank you so much. It's been great.
I think that's amazing. And I really commend you, Jean, on doing that. This is something that I talk about a lot when I speak on any type of health situation or wellness issues going on, but practicing vocalizing. And that's what I'm hearing from you is the acknowledgement, but the vocal acknowledgement of addressing a situation is what will lead to change.
Yeah. And I think just coming from a very vulnerable place, it's the vulnerability, right? It's the vulnerability with the apology and the forgiveness is huge because, and even with the vulnerability, you have to feel safe enough to share that vulnerability. It's like so many contingencies to get to the meat and potatoes of it. But if you value that relationship and you value that connection, you're willing to make yourself feel uncomfortable with the vulnerability to reach that other person, to hear what they have to say and what they've been going through.
Yeah. It really opens the door to healing. And that piece of retiring blame. What's going on if I'm blaming the other person for my being uncomfortable?
Yeah.
And if we allow ourselves to think, oh, it's because they're this, then we're never going to get it. We're not going to grow. And we can do healing in relationships. We can overcome. And I think it's hard. We don't see it modeled very often or it's hard to see. Mm-hmm. Unusual. Mm-hmm. Saying I was wrong is like huge. It goes against our, rugged individualism.
But even just from, I don't know about other cultures, but especially growing up like an Eastern European culture, like my parents never apologized and we never apologized to each other. It was, you would tell if someone was upset or if they did something wrong by the behavior, right? Like the nonverbal language that was happening. But there was no apology. It was just kind of swept under the rug, or once they fell over it, the behavior changed. Oh, and they're coming closer to me now. So I guess I don't want to mess that up. So I'm just going to pretend like it didn't happen either. And I remember when I was older, going through grad school, like learning about all this stuff, I did something that hurt my mom. And I said, I'm sorry. And she's like, you don't need to say sorry to me. You're my daughter. We don't need to apologize. Like, it's fine. I was like, no, mom, we do. Like, I messed up. You feel bad. I'm sorry. And she was just so uncomfortable with that. So I think even receiving apologies for some people might just feel so off because we never received it. So we don't know. It's like, you don't know where to put your hands in a photo. Like, I don't know what to do with my emotions right now because it's awkward.
That's the way somebody could be attempting an authentic apology and we blow it off, which is no. They need to have it recognized. And then, so I've learned to say, thank you. If you don't say any, just thank you so much.
I've been practicing that too, the thank you piece of it. And it reminds me of something that you both spoke about earlier, about when you look at a couple, not to look at them as two individuals, but them together.
This idea about how our culture, the first world culture, in American culture in particular, perhaps, we have thousands and thousands of years of understanding that the only way we're going to survive is if we collaborate and if we're part of community. that we are wired not to be alone. Hence this American thing about being the rugged individual. Rugged individuals are lonely and smoke cigarettes. So there's somewhere I have it on my refrigerator. That loneliness is the equivalent of 15 cigarettes a day. Wow. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, there it is.
Yeah. And I think a lot of loneliness, so there's different, you know, circumstances and nuances, but I think that when we choose to be alone, there's this history of being hurt, of being abandoned in some way. And there's this level of trust that we have to allow to happen to allow other people back into our heart and life. Right. And I think when I think about trust, especially with couples, we think trust is like this one blanket statement, like I trust you or I don't trust you. And I think there's like different nuances to it, right? Like there's, I trust that your intentions are never going to be bad. You might make mistakes and hurt me, but I trust that you will not do something malice. Yes. And then there's the kind of trust where I can trust that you're going to have my back. Like you're going to show up when I need you. You're reliable. You're going to be there. And then there's the kind of trust, like, I don't want to say adequacy or like competency. Like I trust that your intentions are good. I trust that you're going to show up, but I don't trust that you're going to be able to do it right. Mm. Like even let's, for example, like if I had a flat tire, I can call one of my girlfriends who's never changed a tire. I know that she's going to come. I know that she's going to be there and help me, but she may not know how, I don't trust that she'll know how to change the tire. Right. But I trust these other pieces in the relationship. So I think it's interesting to think about like trust in these different lights and nuances with relationships and not have it be kind of like a blanket statement. Like if you broke my trust in one way, it generalizes everything in the relationship. If that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
It does. Mm-hmm. And that was a great visual as well. And it makes me think, cause I know I acknowledged, and it took me years to acknowledge that I think I only related trust to like not cheating on me in a relationship. And then I really sat with it like, wait a second, hold on, you know? So I love that you're explaining that about the nuances. Mm-hmm.
So is there any tips you have for couples who are rebuilding trust? Because trust is really tough to rebuild and repair from.
I'm thinking of a couple that I saw last year. And he had an affair, well, sort of a brief affair, I guess, and how devastating it was to the partner. And yet she was amazing, I have to say. She really got through it. She really wanted to know what was going on in their marriage, that this would happen. Mm-hmm. And she was able to see her part in it, you know, that she had been so involved. They have an autistic child. And that changed her life. They both worked, but his work was something that couldn't change. And that meant she was doing all of the doctor's appointments, all of the educational things, everything. And she wasn't paying attention to him. Mm-hmm. And they were able to get to that. And she was able to take her part. And he was able to see it. Then it was easier for me to stay at work longer. Mm-hmm. And so now they are just, I mean, that and learning about the cycle and sure. He's a withdrawer, sure. You know, all the good things that they came for, but they did a marvelous job. And what was also kind of cool was in the meantime, that autistic child is now doing really, really well and they've gotten the help she needs and she's doing DBT and she's just blossoming. So everybody is doing very well. It's for rebuilding trust, because that was big for her then. How do I know? How would I know? Yeah. And he got, you know, he would text if he's going to be late. He would say no to certain things. No, I got to be home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so he showed that he was trustworthy.
In small ways. Right? Yes,
that's right. That's right. And I will say one other thing that's interesting. There's a book called The Five Love Languages. Oh, yeah. I was so snotty about it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's this pastor, and it's probably, and it is kind of corny, except it's all based on real research. It's like he read Gottman, there's no, and I found that so the five love languages, there's a reason why it's been on the bestseller list for so long. Mm-hmm. I should have given it to each of my grandchildren who've gotten married this year. But I thought, I don't want them to have to think about when it gets bad. It was a revelation to one of my clients. He said, oh my goodness, I've been doing to my wife what I wanted her to do for me. Mm-hmm. Because he was just using his love language, like, sure, this is what I need. And that wasn't what she needed at all. She needed quality time together. She needed, she wasn't interested in gifts. He would give great gifts, but they were lost on her because she wasn't getting what she really needed or wanted. Here we go, her love language. So that's a sweet book that I think can be pretty revelatory.
So there's a website. You can take a quiz for your love language. On there as well, they added in an apology language. I think this is almost as important as, I'll say as important, not more important than the love language, but as important, the five types of apologies. The first one is expressing regret, which that one's important for me. Accepting responsibility is the next one. Then making restitution, which, like, making it right somehow. Genuinely repenting and requesting forgiveness. That's my least favorite.
I would put something in. What's number one?
Number one was expressing regret.
To say specifically, this is what I did. Yeah. This is what, yeah. So express regret, but for what? Mm-hmm. You have to say aloud, I was selfish. I did this so I could show off, or I said this because, then take responsibility. But the what is for, you can't just say a blanket.
Right. For what?
That's right. So when somebody wants to get off with just the, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're going to take them through the five.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that. I'm going to look it up. That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has just been phenomenal with all of the insight, Jean, that you have shared with us. So now we want to ask you the question that we ask everybody who visits with us. What is something you can share with the listeners that your clients might not know about you?
Some people are very surprised to learn that I taught American history in a public high school, that my minor was African American history, that I was very influenced by the civil rights movement, feminism, gay pride, all of those good things. Yeah, so I think that's because I'm not supposed to have that in the therapy room. So sometimes if I've seen somebody for a long time, and it's towards the end, I might share some of that. But
you let your rebel side.
That is right. And actually with the two of you, when we were talking earlier, and I actually said aloud, oh, Janis Joplin was my alter ego. I remember one time saying it to, I was on a board for work with gay, lesbian, and queer folks. And one of the other persons on the board, we were walking and I said something about being a hippie. And he was like, what? You were a hippie? And then I was like, you didn't know that?
Was.
That's right, that's right. I wish I had pictures. I wish I had some of the clothes.
Oh, yes.
Oh baby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yep, awesome. Yeah, it is. It is.
I think that's why we get along so well. I loved speaking to you from the beginning. Is like, I think I'm a hippie at heart, and like maybe in a past life. And so yes. I love that.
Yeah, we really got it, and I so admired you. Do we have a similar curiosity about what's driving this, or and then translating it into something that clients can become mindful of. Mm. Yeah. And again, I want to thank you, all of you, the techs, the two of you ladies, coming up with the questions and getting the best out of me, I hope. So this has been a delight. Aww. Thank you very much.
Thank you so
for
much
having for me as a guest.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming here and being with us. I love talking to you. I could talk to you for hours.
Oh, I know. It's the best.
But I really appreciate you being here. And I think that this is going to be one of the best episodes, and I hope all the listeners get to hear all your amazing and knowledgeable insights. So thank you so
much.
Thank you.
And Jean, before we go, if you could just share how we can contact you and how the listeners can contact you.
Thank you. I am mostly doing, what do you say? Is it
telehealth, virtual telehealth
these days? And I don't know if I will be coming back into Center City. I hope so, because I loved being in the city. Mm-hmm. 2 days a week or 3 days a week or whatever it was. But you can find me on jeanmeston.com. That's my website. And I think and then Psychology Today has a Find a Therapist. Mm-hmm. I'm on there. And I'm now practicing from my home office, which is in Bryn Mawr, PA. So if you put in Bryn Mawr, PA, I'll probably pop up.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, awesome. Pretty good.
Well, thank you so much, Jean.
Thank you. And thank you for that.